Blog Talk Radio.
The clock goes tick tock, the heartbeat tips up. You know there's something greater you're called to be. You shut tight your eyes and breathe in deep.
Welcome to Shapeshifting. I'm Lisa Bonnice, author of Shapeshifting, Reclaiming Your Perfect Body, and this is a very special one-year anniversary show. Last year at this time, when I first started doing the show, we primarily just talked about how to use my book, Shapeshifting, which is about shifting the shape of your body and your life into one that is as authentic, incredible, and expansive as your imagination will allow, using the power of intention, the law of attraction, and by examining where science meets spirituality. And I personally lost 50 pounds and overcame some big health obstacles while writing the book, and members of Shapeshifters groups are seeing stunning results as well, not just in the numbers on the scale, but in their overall lives, because that's what we focus on, our overall contentment and enjoyment with life. We find that a more vibrant health can be a happy side effect of self-realization. Sometimes we find that we're just fine the way we are and that we don't need to fix our bodies, just our self-image, which actually therefore creates our body. And last year, when I first started here on Blog Talk Radio, I really wasn't planning to turn this into an interview show, but so many wonderful guests presented themselves, and in the past year I've interviewed some incredible famous and, well, not so famous authors, healers, and psychics, all people who have added yet another piece of the puzzle to the conversation. People like Neil Donald Walsh, Lynn McTaggart, Bob Doyle from the movie The Secret, sound healer Jonathan Goldman, peace troubadour James Twyman, among many, many others. Check out the archive. Great shows. And today, I could not be happier to be celebrating 1 year on the air by featuring an interview with Apollo 14 astronaut and the sixth man on the moon, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell not only has an incredible story about a life-changing shift in consciousness that occurred on his trip home from the moon, he's also the founder of the Institute of Noetic Science. This is guaranteed to be an incredible once-in-a-lifetime conversation, so stay tuned. And then for the rest of July, I'll be doing a one-year retrospective featuring the best of Shapeshifting shows for the past year. And just so you don't have to try to remember all of that, you can always log on to shapeshiftingonline.com for more information on the radio show. Also links to Dr. Edgar Mitchell's site, to the Institute of Noetic Science, anything else we might talk about on the show today. Check out shapeshiftingonline.com afterwards for links. You can also then find out how to join a Shapeshifters group or to access any of the other helpful tools designed to get to the bottom of what's keeping you from your most incredible expression of self. And I think that's enough announcements for now. Without further ado, let's get started. My guest today has so many accomplishments to list that they could fill the entire hour, so I'll just hit the high points. Edgar Mitchell's academic background includes a Bachelor of Science in Industrial Management from Carnegie Mellon University, a Bachelor of Science from the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School, and a Doctor of Science in Aeronautics and Astronautics from MIT. The guy actually is a rocket scientist. In addition to his Navy training, he also flew with Chuck Yeager, you know, the whole right stuff crowd, and Dr. Mitchell was instrumental in designing the lunar module in which he would one day land on the moon. And in fact, during the Apollo 13 mission, for which he was actually originally scheduled with Alan Shepard and Stuart Roosa, that's the one, if you recall, where Jim Lovell, Fred Hayes, and Jack Swigert were trapped in a dangerously damaged spacecraft, and as you've seen in the movie Apollo 13, when Gary Sinise as Ken Mattingly was in the command module simulator trying to figure out how to bring them back alive, back to Earth alive, in real life, Ed Mitchell was in the lunar module simulator pre-testing the protocol for the burns and devising procedures for manual control of the engines, should that be necessary. So he played a big part in bringing those guys back alive. And then the following year, in January 1971, he, Alan Shepard, and Stu Roosa took the very next trip to the moon on Apollo 14. He and Al Shepard hold the record for the longest ever moonwalking session, which was 9 hours and 17 minutes. And on the way back, he had an epiphany that changed the course of his life forever. And that's a story I'm going to be asking him to tell because I couldn't do it justice. And that's why he's here. Dr. Mitchell has received many awards and honors, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the U.S. Navy Distinguished Medal, 3 NASA Group Achievement Awards. He was inducted into the Space Hall of Fame in 1979 and the Astronaut Hall of Fame in 1998. And he was a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2005. Founder of Institute of Noetic Science and author of the incredible book, please pick up a copy, it's amazing, The Way of the Explorer, an Apollo Astronaut's Journey Through the Material and Mystical Worlds. It is my honor to welcome him today. Ed Mitchell, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Lisa. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It is such a pleasure to have you here. I am so in love with your story. Reading your book, I also downloaded the audio version so I could actually hear you telling the story. It made me breathless to hear you tell exactly what happened on the whole trip. And I have to ask you first, before we get into that, how did you get the courage to follow the Apollo 13 Michigan and actually go into space?
Well, we solved all the problems that were keeping us out, so let's go.
Wow. Okay, well, simple as that, huh?
That's what it is. We just knew it was a risky mission, but a risky venture, but we solved the problems that defeated us the last time, and so everything was ready to go.
Well, you know what? That is true. You did mention in the book that that you have a certain mindset when you do this kind of work, where panic just isn't even it's not even an option. You get the job done.
That's right. You have to. It's something you cultivate. And of course, I was a pilot during the Korean War and a test pilot, and those things take a little getting control of one's emotions.
I suppose the lure to be actually walking on the moon has got to be a little bit more powerful than the fear of death.
Yes, that's if you tend to be an explorer, and we were all explorers, that's what you're looking for, is that wonderful new insight as to how things are made and how they're put together, and that's what we do.
Wow, it's just so fantastic. As I mentioned, just hearing you telling the story about being on the moon, walking to the crater's edge, and I wanted to ask you too. What you're talking about, the moon dust, the surface of the moon, is it sand? Is it powder? Is it dust? What's the consistency like?
It's actually basalt rock, or basalt, in other words, lava rock, but from the inside of the moon. But in the ancient times, when the lava flowed out onto the surface, and it mostly flowed on this surface, since the same side of the moon points to the Earth all the time, thanks to gravitational attraction. But then after it flowed, the lava flows came out into the craters and filled them. For billions of years, it's been beaten up by meteor impact into very, very fine dust, like talcum powder, the consistency about of talcum powder.
Huh.
And but it is basalt rock, has a smell very much like talcum, rather than gunpowder.
Really?
And but it's so fine that it's unimaginably fine, just ground to the finest constituency.
Huh. Yeah, that's kind of what it looks like in footage that I've seen. But I mean, you were actually there.
Yeah.
It's so wonderful. So now your footprints are on the moon forever.
Well, they stay there for a long, long time, but of course there's still meteor impacts, rather tiny micrometeorites, and the meteors are getting smaller. The moon has wiped out much of the longest trajectory, many of the asteroids and the meteors that impact, but it's still being impacted. And, yes, they'll be there for a long time.
A good long time, or at least until we send more people up and they walk all over them. And
exactly.
And I also wonder, I hope you don't mind my enthusiasm, because I'm so fascinated by this story that I might even be going out of order with the questions I wanted to ask. You are one of 12 people in the history of history to actually do this. So, again, I'm honored to be able to ask you this. What's it like on the dark side of the moon when you're going around the backside and you're out of radio contact and you are completely disconnected from us? What did that feel like?
That's pretty black out there, particularly if you want to, if you shut down the spacecraft lighting systems and want to experience really black. It is black. And of course, there's starlight if you look out.
Right.
And there's bright stars. When you're out of touch with the Earth and over on the backside and outside of the sunlight, yes, it gets pretty dark.
Wow. So there's no light on that side. Starlight doesn't even illuminate it a little bit?
Well, the stars, when you look at the stars, they're very bright.
Uh-huh.
But compared with a moonlit night, you see, it's still pretty dark stuff.
Huh. Wow. Amazing. Just amazing. And then you also tell the story of what it was like to sleep on the moon after you landed and went out and did some work. You and Al Shepard went back into the lunar module. And tell us what that was like.
Well, it was fun. I mean, we slept in the spacecraft. However, we did happen to land on a little bit of an incline. And as a result, the feeling in that reduced gravitation, since your floor is kind of uneven beneath you, you have the feeling that you're about to tip over. And even though we were sleeping, we were uncomfortable, and we got up a couple of times to look outside. Now, we knew better, but nevertheless, you went with your feeling.
Uh-huh.
And you took a look outside the spacecraft to make sure you weren't tipping over.
But you were saying that the silence was just palpable, and that you were aware of the fact that you were the only two living beings on this entire rock.
Yeah, and occasionally there was the Mylar heat. It's not a heat shield, it's a thermal panel on the body of the lunar module. You would hear little noises of it crinkling as tiny micrometeorites would hit it. And that was an interesting sound. We weren't quite prepared for that one, but it did. But everything was fine.
Wow, amazing. And then also one of the things that you did that I didn't mention in the introduction because I wanted you to discuss this is you and a couple of friends of yours, you called yourself the three Eds. They were both Dr. Eds as well. Before you left Earth, you were doing psychic experiments, experimenting with ESP, with the cards with the little figures on them. And you actually brought some of these with you on your trip.
Not quite, but it's similar. I just copied a table of random numbers down. I didn't take any card.
Oh, okay.
I just copied the random numbers down and did the experiment that way, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we were both fans. All of us had studied Dr. Rhine's work at Duke and parapsychology. And, of course, it was disdained by mainstream science. But the evidence was so strong, it was real, that we all realized we needed an explanation and science. And it turns out, now that we've come back and done all of this, that quantum mechanics provides us a mechanism for the way all that works.
Okay. So what you were actually testing, your reasoning for bringing this out to space, is to see if distance had anything.
Exactly. If distance would affect the results. And it turns out we got as good results at space distances that they got in the laboratory. So that showed that distance had nothing or very, very little to do with the results.
Right, and it was kind of funny. When you got back to Earth, when word got out that this is what you did, NASA was not really all that thrilled, were they?
Well, no, nothing was ever said. The problem was that it got out into the press, and before it was supposed to get into the press, one of our participants really couldn't stand to be quiet and broke the news prematurely. But the press was not particularly laudatory about all of that.
Yeah, there were people saying, you know, that the government was doing a psychic experimentation and making it sound like a conspiracy theory when it was just three men being curious about taking advantage of an opportunity that you would never have again.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow. And then, so you spent, what, 2 days on the moon, basically?
Well, 34, actually, it was 34 hours. And you said earlier our walk was 9 hours. It's actually two walks of 9 hours. Almost 5 hours each. And yes, we did make the longest trek on foot on the moon during that period.
Now, is that why it was record-breaking? Because in your book, you're talking about how you were trying to get to a certain location, but distance looks different there, so it was actually further away than you expected?
No, we knew exactly how far it was. It just looked further away, or the distances. We misjudge distances in real time. Like being in the desert here on Earth, and you see distant mountains over there, and they're a lot further away than they look on a clear day.
Okay, I see. So in the meantime, while you're trying to get to where you're going, Fred Hayes is over on the intercom saying, come back, and you hadn't quite made it.
Well, we had a very precise routine that we went through. It's just that the geologists that were monitoring the work and had set up the work for us, and we were getting data that they wanted, they wanted us to be very precise in our navigation in the path that we took to get to the top of the top of Cone Crater, which is our object that we were headed for. And we could get to the top of Cone Crater, but we couldn't find our local landmarks as precisely as they wanted. And so we were not as accurate in the path that we went to the top of the crater as they would have liked. They knew in retrospect, because we did good photography and got excellent photographs, and they could place us precisely once they had the photographs back on Earth. It's just that we couldn't place ourselves precisely within meters. And they were talking about within a few meters on the way up.
Okay, I see. So after your time on the moon, which, as you mentioned in the book, you were basically too busy to even think about what you were doing, to even be awestricken by the fact that you were on the moon.
Well, our job, we were the first mission to do science on the moon. And our job was to set up a science station and to do a geologic trek up to Cone Crater collecting data. Stephen, the notion is that when a meteor plows into a surface, it turns out a huge flap of soil, and that represents the geology deep into this crater. And the crater, Cone Crater, was our objective. And it was 1,000 feet across and about 800 feet deep. And if we got to the material near the rim, that would be material that was close to the 800 feet deep. And the shallower stuff was scattered out toward the spacecraft. And our task was to pick up samples all along that represented the various layers in this Cone Crater, which is what we did. The only thing that we couldn't do in real time was know precisely at the landmark that we were trying to find for sampling.
Huh. Okay. So then when you did get back into the lunar module and headed back toward Earth.
They knew exactly where we were at that. Well, when they got the data back on Earth, they knew, could tell exactly where we had been.
Okay, all right. So then when you were actually, the big epiphany that your story is sort of pivotal around, the life-changing moment, actually occurred after you left the moon, is that correct?
Yes. Well, after we left the moon, a successful mission, we had accomplished all of our objectives, including Alan hitting his golf ball and me throwing a javelin after it. That was our little moment of liberty near the end of the mission. And so we were on our way home, having successfully done what we set out to do, and I had a little more time to relax since my major challenges had been completed, and the time to look out the window. And we were positioned and rotating the spacecraft to keep thermal balance on it, and positioned in such a way that once every 2 minutes, the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and a 360-degree panorama of the heavens appeared in the spacecraft window, in the porthole. And that was awesome. That really is a powerful experience to see the heavens that way and to see Earth as this tiny little planet. And it made me, since I had studied astronomy at Harvard and MIT, getting my doctorate, it made me realize that the molecules in my body and in the spacecraft were prototyped or manufactured in some ancient generation of stars. And suddenly, instead of intellectual knowledge, it became very personal. Those were my molecules that had been manufactured in there. And there was an enormous sense of oneness, recognizing that those were my molecules, and I was connected to those stars. And I had never had such a powerful experience like this and didn't know what it was all about. And it continued when I had a few moments to look out the window all the way home. And I thought at the time that humans have asked the question, who are we? How do we get here? Where are we going? What is our relationship to the cosmos? They've asked this question forever. But, of course, no one had been out among it. And I realized that here we, since we were the first generation of spacefarers from Earth, we perhaps needed to rethink and re-ask those questions from this privileged point of view. And I realized that our cosmology, our answers to those questions, as described in science, was probably incomplete, was certainly incomplete, and perhaps flawed. And our cosmology from our cultural traditions, normally rooted in religion, were archaic and perhaps flawed. And maybe we really needed to revisit these questions. And that the that for the last 400 years, since the late 16th century, when René Descartes came to the conclusion that body, mind, physicality were two different realms of reality. The positive side effect of that is it got the Inquisition off the backs of the intellectuals of that period, so they quit burning them at the stake for disagreeing with the church. But on the downside, it caused science to arise totally and be, for 400 years, a strictly materialist proposition, believing that mind and consciousness was simply an accident of molecular interaction. And only in the beginning of the 20th century did we start to realize from quantum mechanics that mind and matter do interact and that Descartes was wrong. And so that's been the what I've helped bring to science in recent years, is to bring this notion that consciousness is a proper study for science. And that was what the ESP experiment was about, because science is about anomalies, and the psychic realm was totally anomalous to classical physics. And here's that story.
Okay, yeah, and then you take that even further into talking about the Newtonian worldview, about how the belief about physical reality is irrelevant, that the universe is simply there and man is a passive observer, and that's sort of how we as a society, as a civilization, have sort of gotten stuck into believing that's the way it is, and what your work focuses on is showing it's exactly the opposite.
Well, yeah, I take the position as a philosopher, scientist, thinker these days, and have since those days, that the two extremes of thinking, going back to ancient times, that consciousness is the fundamental stuff, and that matter is simply an illusion, it's a product of mind, but an elusive product of mind. And on the other extreme is the science, early science notion that consciousness is simply an epiphenomenon, an accident of molecular interaction. Those are the two extremes. And I said, well, I don't think either one of them is correct, so let's just continue to investigate, and we'll probably find the truth somewhere in between.
Right, right in the middle.
So that has been my approach to this, as I founded the Institute of Neurotic Sciences, to properly study and bring consciousness into the to an understanding using the tools of science. And that occurred because of this epiphany in space, which said we really should take a new look at these deep questions about ourselves.
Right, and one of the things that you said about the epiphany was that this wasn't a God-touching moment, that you realized that it didn't have anything to do with God specifically. So your work actually sort of goes between science and spirituality, where dogma is not really entered into what you
look
into.
That statement changed that just a little bit.
Okay.
There were many of my colleagues had similar types of experiences, And some of them were far more rooted in a religious concept than was I at that point. And they did explain this type of experience in terms of their religious belief. I chose, as a more of a scientist and philosopher, to say, we don't really know the answer here. Let's keep investigating and trying to find out how to bring consciousness into science, because that it has been missing in the 400 years since Newtonian times. And it's needed. If science is going to be complete, we have to be able to understand how consciousness arose in the universe. And perhaps our stories about it are archaic. Perhaps they're not, but we'll find out.
Right, and you also mentioned that in the history of mankind, there really wasn't a whole lot of even discussion about consciousness until fairly recently in our history. It's almost like we just all of a sudden got it and started looking into it.
Well, it has been, that is true. It has been assumed in most philosophic systems, and epistemology is the science, is the philosophy, actually, that should ask the question, how do we know what we know? And for many years, it's assumed that our observations were indeed valid and real just by being observations. But it turns out that interpretation is what we do. And we interpret from our base of experience what reality is from our observations. And we know it's quite fallible. And the best way to test that, of course, is ask a dozen people who watch an accident, and you'll get a dozen answers as to what happened. And this is where science comes in, to have a means of testing our observations of reality and conducting experiments and finding out where the anomalies are, what doesn't fit, and then changing it around to accomplish a new experiment that tests that idea. And so that's what we've been doing.
Okay. And that sort of leads into another thing you discussed about how information is sometimes confused with having a message specifically, whereas the message is actually inherent in each of us. We gather the information. You told a story, an example of a family of four hearing a fire truck going by.
Right, right. And, that's a nice little analogy. The father is a fireman, and the wife is thinking about safety of her children, and the fire truck's not going down their street, and a deaf mother-in-law doesn't hear anything at all, so she doesn't interpret anything. So the point was that we get information, and we interpret it according to what we believe and what our interests are.
Right. Yeah, and so that our belief system actually does create our reality. You found
it helped. Yeah, exactly right. And the fact that we now have done experiments to show that mind does affect matter, and our choosing does affect matter, and we can affect it in very profound ways. So we do influence our reality by the way we think and the way we believe.
Right, and that you also discovered that various psychics, because you've worked with amazing number of people over the years with really powerful abilities, and you found that every one of these people basically explains the exact same gift that they share according to their own belief system.
Exactly, and that's exactly the point here. Why we need, and only it's been in the last 100 years or so that psychology has arisen to try to help us realize these types of points, and that our belief system does shape how we interpret reality.
And two of the people that you work with in particular, Uri Geller, the spoon bending guy. I'd love to hear you tell about that, but I also want to hear you talk about your mother's experience with Norbu Chen. That is one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard.
Yes, that's quite a story, and it helped me understand this very point that our belief systems affect our reality. And very briefly, the story was my mother was suffering glaucoma. And her eyesight was such that her prescription was, her eyesight was about 2200 in modern measure, which is legally blind without glasses. And she came to a conference that I was speaking at, and there happened to be a Tibetan healer there. And I had not really worked with healers before and was a bit skeptical myself. But he purported to do that, and so my devious mind said, okay, let's see if we can get Mom and this guy together and what comes out of it. And we did. Mother was a good sport. She agreed to this. So we assembled in my room that evening, and he did his mantra and his administration, actually putting his energy to her. And after about 20 minutes, said, go to your room, have some grape juice or broth, treat yourself as though you've had major surgery, sleep well, and let's see what tomorrow brings. And my mother came into my room the next morning at 6 o'clock in the suite that we had, and her Bible in one hand, her glasses in the other, and waking me up and said, son, praise the Lord, I can see, I can see. And so I came out of the sleep kind of befuddled a bit, and I said, well, that's good, Mom. And yes, praise the Lord, I can see. Dropped her glasses on the floor, ground them under her heel, and broke them, and then drove home 200 miles without her glasses, legally blind by medical standards and legal standards. And what was I to do? I invited Norbu Chun to come live with me so I could figure out what he did, which he eventually did.
Uh-huh.
But the part of the story that's really interesting is that I talked to Mother every day for a week, and things were just wonderful. But a week later, she called me, and I could tell as soon as I picked up the phone and knew she was there that something was wrong. I said, Mom, what's the problem? And she wanted to know, since my mother was a very deep fundamentalist Christian, she wanted to know if Norbu was Christian. And I didn't want to answer because I knew what was coming. And finally I said, no, Mom, he's not a Christian, but he's a Buddhist, and he's a very, very good man. She said, oh, I've been healed by Satan. And as a result, she had to go get her thick Coke bottle glasses back, re-prescribed. Now, her glaucoma didn't come back, but she wasn't permitting herself to see or to be healed. Now, my mother was a very bright lady, but and she passed away 10 years later. But her eyesight continued to improve from that point on. And when she passed away 10 years later, her eyesight was she just required a very minimal reading glasses. In other words, her mind had said, I got rid of this healing, I didn't accept it, but if I got rid of it, I should be able to get it back. And so she got it back. And I think that's it. That taught me the role of belief system.
Yeah. Yeah, well, because you were raised, you know, your typical American upbringing with a basic religious...
Exactly.
And so how did you, when you first started looking into this, how did you really begin to reconcile? Because there is a lot of fear. When you're raised with Satan as, you know, the bad guy, that's a big mountain to climb.
Well, my father was a very spiritual man. He was less religious. His love of nature and his interaction with nature, his animals, the herds of cattle that we had, the growing crops, just people in general. My father was a type of man that never had an enemy, give you the shirt off his back if you needed it. And his love was nature and the animals in his life. And so I learned a lot from him. And then I got very close to a very enlightened preacher of the faith and talked to him about this, and he was a very philosophic man and understood where I was coming from and was very encouraging and asking deep questions like I continue to do.
Okay. Now, tell me about Uri Geller.
Well, Uri was one of these people brought to me by a medical scientist, Andrea Pihartik, who was quite an inventor himself, but who discovered Uri in Israel and realized that he was quite a powerful young psychic in many, many ways. And because he knew, thanks to this pre-announcement of the ESP experiment in space, called me and said, I know you're interested in these things. I have found this very powerful young psychic that you might want to take a look at. And Uri was only about 21 or 2 at that time. And so Andrea brought him to the United States. I spent a week with him at Andrea's estate in New York and found him to be powerful. He could do many different mind-over-matter type events. And again, we took him to Stanford Research Institute where we did a lot of tests on remote viewing and all types of experiments, further convincing me that the power of these things. And so I set out then within the Institute to bring science, to try to understand them in terms of science. And by and large, started realizing that the use of quantum mechanics was the tool that we really needed, and that most of these events, that minor romantic events, can be handled within the framework of quantum mechanics, and that's what I've done for many years now.
Well, how did he actually, did he ever explain how he does the spoon bending?
Well, he doesn't quite really know how he does it. he just has quite an amazing capability. He just knows that he can do it. As do others. I've worked with others, just like Norbu Chen, doing the healing. What Uri did is not significantly different than a healing one. Healing, what a healer does, is just a different facet of the same process. And intentionality has a lot to do with it. And I don't quite know what more to say because
there was no explanation. Now, I know that you did say that after he was on, I believe you said he was on The Tonight Show doing the spoon bending, and then you were deluged with contact from parents saying that their children saw them and that they're doing it now because they saw him.
Yes, this is one of the things that showed that what Uri was doing was really quite real, in spite of the fact that professionals said, oh, no, it has to be all trickery, was that children that watched him on television shows, and the mothers knew that I had been involved, or somehow Uri wasn't bashful without letting him know I'd been involved. And so mothers would be calling me and say, what's happened to my little Johnny? He's bending spoons like Uri Geller because he watched Uri Geller. And so I went and examined a few of them, and of course they hadn't been taught that they couldn't do that.
Right.
So their mind was quite open to that sort of event, and they were quite good at it.
And you said that the majority of them were boys under the age of 10. Any idea why that was?
I think mostly because they were just curious and wanted to try, and hadn't been taught they couldn't do it. And we all have those natural abilities. When, our children have their little imaginary playmates, and we train them out of that when they are visioning these sorts of things. And boys are generally, I think, a little more courageous in doing these type of things than generally girls are. But I don't know exactly the answer to that.
Huh. Okay. Now, I assume you've seen the movie The Matrix with the little boy and the spoon.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
There is no spoon?
Something like that.
Yeah. I can't think of a better explanation for it. Now, you were talking about people attacking Uri Geller, saying that, or trying to debunk him. And one of my favorite lines from your book says that when our belief systems are in question, our reflex attacks the new in order to maintain the integrity of the old.
Yeah, well, that's true. Exactly right.
I think that's just so powerful.
We do not really like change if it threatens what we believe about things and threatens our security. And Max Planck said it very nicely at the end of the 19th century. Change isn't accomplished by convincing skeptics, but funeral by funeral.
That's great.
Well, I wish it weren't so great, but it is what happens.
Okay, it's poignant then. Maybe it's not great. So then you moved into founding the Institute of Noetic Science, which has been around now since, what was it, the mid-70s?
Over 35 years, right.
35 years, yeah. And they've done amazing work. I know Lynn McTaggart works closely with you. She was on the show
yes.
A couple weeks ago, and she does the intention experiments, that type of thing. What are your favorite things that have come out of your association, the things that you've learned?
Well, the main thing is to try to discover the nature of reality in the larger picture. And one of the more amazing things that has happened in our time is Hubble Space Telescope, to bring us back pictures of distant galaxies, galactic clusters, and being able to see further than we've ever seen before, and recognizing that the universe we live in is far more complex and vast and reaches further out than we've ever thought, and is really markedly changing our view of astronomy. And this process of discovering dark energy and dark matter and new properties of the universe, probably in the next few years, we will have to be changing our cosmology very significantly in understanding how the universe came into being. And maybe there's more than one universe, whatever that is.
Really? So you're talking about the Big Bang?
Yes. It does not really appear to some of us that the Big Bang is really the right answer. And we'll just have to see.
Worked for us for a while during a certain period of understanding, but once new information... I'm reminded of... have you seen Unforgiven, Clint Eastwood? Fantastic movie, basically a Western, where there's this young boy. He's trying to figure out how to defy a $1,000 reward by three ways. And as I was watching the movie, I was like, oh, okay, I can see how if you've never had any concept of math at all, where something that is a no-brainer to us now, well, of course, it's $333.33333 cents, you know. Yep. But if you've never learned anything about your basic numbers, that is a complete mystery. So
of
I can
course.
See how what we're doing now, even though we think we are so advanced and so on top of things, we really don't know anything yet, do we?
Well, I often say we think we're pretty smart, and the last 100 and so years, got a thunderstorm going on. The last 100 or so years has been quite amazing. We're just barely out of the trees in our knowledge. We really don't know a lot yet.
Yeah, that's very true. So what do you think is coming? What do you think is the future of space exploration? I know that you had hoped to go to Mars.
Well, I think we will in due course go to Mars, provided we don't blow ourselves up with our stupidities and our wars in the meantime.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a big if. Also, we are not on a sustainable path at this moment. The very success of our sciences and our technologies, coupled with our belief system now that money and wealth is really the key to happiness, which is a false belief system, is running rife with the economy of the world. And our numbers, the best estimate is that we can probably support roughly 2 billion people on this earth with the lifestyles and consumption patterns of Western industrial society. And right now we have over 6 billion people, so something's got to give.
Right. So do you have any ideas about sustainability? Any?
Well, there are a lot of things that we can all do, but it's, the main thing it will take is simply a shift in our awareness and a shift in this belief system away from the greed that is consuming us right now. The only model that the corporate economic system has is more is better, and that unfortunately is not necessarily true, and it's doing us in.
Right. So what would you? How have you changed your life specifically with this in mind? What are you doing about making change in your own personal?
Well, I live very simply. I try to live as green as possible, and. All of my efforts devoted in my lectures and as I travel around the world is trying to move people onto a more aware path to recognize there's a problem, and that each one of us has to contribute to the solution. It's not one you can mandate a solution to. We all have to be a part of it.
Right. So it just has to be.
And
our
it begins
own.
With our it begins with our belief that we can solve the problem.
Okay. All right, so basically having a belief that we can solve the problem enables us to do so.
Well, that we can solve the problem enables us to do so, and not even thinking about it almost assures that we won't solve it.
Okay, point well made. Absolutely. So what are the areas of research that you think that mainstream science fails to explore? What do you think we could be doing?
Well, science, it's not a matter of the science here. The science can help us with it. But it's that we have to decide to live more simply. We have to decide to find new energy sources. It's quite clear that peak oil is upon us, that we can't count on oil being our energy supply for the indefinite future, and we have to find other sources. And it's not likely that that ethanol is a replacement because that competes with our, but the growing vegetables and things compete, or having something to eat competes with the production of ethanol.
Right.
So we've got to solve that one. So it's a very, very difficult problem, and we have to slow down our reproduction rate a bit. We're producing too many people. We'll have over 6.5 billion people now, and hopefully it'll slow down before we get to 9 or 10. But it's a problem we all have to confront and deal with.
Now, this is just a kind of a goofy question off the top of my head, but it seems that people are also, not only are they being born at a rapid pace, they're also, there's a lot of natural disasters going on right now where they're dying off in huge numbers.
Well, that is true, but the population, the longevity, average longevity continues to increase, so we're living much longer, and our science and technology are helping increase our longevity, as well as certainly some of our medical procedures. But the answer to it is not a simple answer. If we want to preserve our people and quit, the whole notion is violence only begets more violence. But we're continuing to create violence, and we're tending to create wars, which is destructive. And until we learn to live together in harmony, and learn to live together cooperatively, we'll keep on doing this, and we're not really be solving the problem.
Okay. Well, do you feel at least optimistic that we're maybe on the right path? Because sometimes I feel like there are a large number of us who are moving in the right direction, but I'm just not quite sure that we're at that tipping point yet.
Well, I'm not sure that we are either, and unfortunately, I wish I could say that we were, but I don't know that that's true. And it is unfortunate that we can't see that more clearly, and that we can't help people more clearly. In my mind, transformation or transcendent thinking is a very major key, and if we can help get people to respond to transform type of thinking more readily, which is what I'm all about, and my Institute of Nordic Sciences is all about. That will help us bring things in, hopefully, in a better way.
Right. Now, you say that you've noticed a speeding up of the evolution of consciousness just since the 1980s. Is that right?
Yes, I think it has happened. But also, in some measure, it has slowed down because it seems like the population growth has somewhat overwhelmed us.
Okay.
And the global economic system is so concentrated on growth, untrammeled growth, that growth is the answer to everything, and greed and more is better is the answer to everything, and that is a totally false notion.
Right. It feels like things are coming to a head, and it's just. A very short, this is what it feels like anyway, that any minute now things are just going to pop and we're all going to almost be forced to look at what's really important.
Well, I think that's probably true. We probably will go through some very serious times, and certainly with oil prices being what they are and putting the economic system in jeopardy, it's going to force a reevaluation of things. Let's hope it forces a reevaluation in the right direction. And if we get enough people thinking correctly about this, then we'll make progress. I have the belief we can make progress.
I do, too. In fact, if you look at, I don't want to necessarily get into politics or anything, but if you look at the election that's coming up, whether you agree with the candidates or not, you have to admit, everyone has to admit that there is definitely change in the air, that there's definitely a shift in people's perspectives, that there is change. That the fact that the United States isn't so well respected around the world is kind of making all of us say, okay, well, maybe we need to change the way that we're doing things.
Yes, I think that hopefully this administration will represent a tipping point to get back toward a more sane approach to world affairs and less violence.
Right.
And to concentrating on these major issues associated with sustainability.
Yeah.
And environmental protection, yeah.
Is ION's Institute of Noetic Science involved at all in that type of thing?
Well, yes, and we have reshaped our mission there to focus on transformation and helping get us to that point.
Really? What are you working on?
Well, it's all of the aspects of that associated with personal, global, or rather societal, cultural, global transformation.
Okay.
How do we move more and more people, and it begins with individuals, more and more people into the lifestyle and the thought patterns that we are necessary here for exactly what we're talking about.
Okay. So where does one begin? If you've never even given this any thought, what would be a good first step for somebody new to this whole thing to begin?
Recognizing that we're on an unsustainable path and asking the question, what can I do to help?
So you're talking about recycling?
Recycling is a part of it.
Okay.
Different automobiles is a part of it. Living the green life. In other words, conserving. Teaching our children to conserve. In other words, get into it and live it individually, and we'll see where it goes.
Okay. Wonderful. Okay, well, we are coming to the end of the show. Wow. is there anything that I have not asked you about that you particularly would like to talk about, to state?
Well, I think we've kind of covered the waterfront. Sustainability and how do we get there is the major issue that I focus on these days. And I'm very deep into some of the things that have come out of the world of quantum mechanics as far as consciousness is concerned, and how we help people perceive things. Most of what we considered mystical in the past is really explainable within the context of our quantum world. And I'm very busy doing that because it's very useful to us, I believe.
Yeah, and I am so grateful for your work and people like you who have blazed the path for the rest of us, because I know when I'm trying to explain to family and friends who don't know anything about the consciousness or spirituality, it just I come up against resistance as well. You know, that whole no, this isn't the way I think, or that's evil, and,
yeah.
And so it's wonderful that you're doing what you're doing.
I think we're making a difference, and that's about the best any of us can do is try to make a significant difference.
Absolutely. Well, wonderful. Let me make sure that I have any websites that you want mentioned.
Sure.
I have your website. It's edmitchellapollo14.com. Is that correct?
Yes, apollo14.com.
Right, okay.
And noetic.org.
Okay.
And a new one, Quantrek, Quantrek.org.
Okay.
Which focuses more on the hard sciences as opposed to the transformational science.
Okay. You say that's Quantrek.org.
E-R-E-K.
E-K. Okay. Quantrek. Ah, it's in Star Trek.
Quantrek.
Okay. All right. I will add that to my website at Shapeshifting Online for anybody interested
All right.
in that. Okay. Once again, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut, sixth man on the moon. There's only 12 of them out there. I'm really delighted that you were able to join me today. And, I'm just so thrilled to talk to you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure being with you.
Well, thank you for being here today.
Mm-hmm.
Folks, that was Dr. Edgar Mitchell. You can pick up his book, The Way of the Explorer, An Apollo Astronaut's Journey Through the Material and Mystical Worlds. Great book, really. In fact, you can download it from audible.com, so you can actually hear him telling his story in his own words, which is really just such a kick. Let's see. As I mentioned at the top of the show, this month, July, is going to be a shape-shifting retrospective, where basically I'm going to go through the archives and pick out my favorite shows, the ones that I personally learned the most out of or enjoyed in particular. So watch for that. And I've got some interesting new things maybe cooking in August. We'll see. We'll see what's going on. Things are changing. Things are shifting. Thank you, folks, for being in the chat room today. Appreciate your being here. Gosh, I'm not sure what else to say. I'm going to take a month off, so I will see you folks coming up probably in August. Once again, Edgar Mitchell, thank you for being here. Talk to you folks soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.